This episode of Where Did the Road Go is brought to you in part by our Patreons. If you want to become a patron, go to wheredidtheroadgo.com. And now our show.
Transmission start. Welcome to Where Did the Road Go? Join us as we wander off the path and explore lost history, consciousness, the paranormal, unexplained mysteries, alternative thought, and much more. We are present on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com. Now here is your host, Soraya.
Greetings and welcome to this edition of Where Did the Road Go? This will be the last show, I guess, for 2017. And I have lots of cool stuff for 2018 already planned. It'll be our five-year anniversary, actually, at the end of January. And the plan is to do a UFO history with Aaron Gullius and Mike Cleland for just the year of 2017, which a lot of stuff happened. So there should be a nice diversity of opinion between them, and we will get to that. I think it'll initially air on the 27th of January, and like I said, that's our five-year anniversary. So I want to thank everyone listening, everyone who has supported us in any way for getting us this far in. I really didn't know the show was going to last. It was something I wanted to do, but I didn't know if anyone was going to care. So thank you so much, everyone, for your comments, your recommendations, Patreons, everything. And also, if you're getting this on iTunes, a few five-star ratings on more on iTunes would definitely be helpful, getting the exposure out there, if you're so inclined. So that's it for right now. We're going to go into this second part of my talk with Laird Scranton, and I hope you enjoy it. All right, and so I'm back here with Laird Scranton, and your new book is called Seeking the Primordial, and we're going to continue on with our conversation here about some of the really deep stuff you have in this book. We left off talking about the flaw in creation, and I'm really interested in the concept of I've always found the whole Yuga cycle, Great Year thing really interesting. Whatchamacallit, who wrote The Lost Star?
Walter Crittenden, right?
Yeah, he was one of the first people I ever talked to. Prior to doing this show, I did it on my music show because I found his book so fascinating. But you're finding that this stuff kind of aligns with some of what he's saying.
Well, it certainly aligns with the concept of the Yuga cycle, and it certainly aligns with the concept of precession, but it differs a little bit in causes. Originally, the perspective that Walter was approaching this from was that there was a binary relationship that existed between Sirius and our sun, and that because of that rotation, our sun was drawn closer to and further away from the galactic center, and that electromagnetic effects from the galactic center were responsible for changes in perception of humanity in terms of our ability to perceive the non-material. The Dogen perspective is in the ballpark with that, but it emphasizes some different things. At bottom here, the concept is scrolling energy, and we have parallelism between what happens in the microcosm and what happens in the macrocosm. Now, in the macrocosm, the structure that's responsible for conveying that scrolling energy is called a stellar bubble. And the nearest example we have in our region of the universe of a stellar bubble is a structure called Barnard's Loop. This is a very faint spiraling birthplace of stars that actually centers on Orion's belt, but its light is so faint that we can't see it. If you image it with time-lapse photography, you can image the spiral that, say, centers right there on the belt of Orion. The Dogon refer to this as the chariot of Orion, and when you image it, it looks like, gives the impression of the wheel of a chariot that Orion the Hunter is standing in. Now, the idea from the perspective of this cosmology I've been pursuing is that the rotation of that spiral is the structure that has enough mass to influence what looks to us like the rotation of the constellations. That as it moves around, that Buddhism is suggesting that the Sirius stars, even though they're set sort of obliquely to our viewpoint, the Sirius stars actually sit at the center of the spiral of that rotation. And so they're in the position of, if you imagine yourself as a child on a spinning merry-go-round, if Sirius is sitting at the center of the merry-go-round, then as we spin, everything around us looks like it's also spinning, except Sirius, which is sitting in the center, which seems to be staying in the same place. That's the effect that's happening. And the Sirius stars are two stars that don't seem to precess. If precession is the slow apparent rotation of the constellations around the Earth over a very long period of time, it's about a 25,000-year cycle. Now, that half cycle is what's important to the concept of the yuga in Buddhism. The idea is that during a roughly 12 to 13,000-year half cycle, that humanity goes through four stages. We are either just finishing or just past the least spiritually aware phase of that. And so we're presumably either just on the way back up ascending or just about to be on the way back up. It depends on which source you talk to or listen to, which right. one you trust. The Hebrew calendar makes it look as if we're just now at the extent of that scrolling process. But in the cosmology, the non-material universe, the fully ascended non-material universe, is described as having perfect knowledge, but an inability to act. Now, that makes sense if we think of the way time works, that in a non-material frame, essentially all events happen at once, which means that perfect knowledge would be possible. But also, because the time frame is so quick, there's no effective moment of time in which to take an action. And so the non-material universe is said to have perfect consciousness, but an inability to act. Perfect knowledge, but an inability to act. The material side is said to have imperfect knowledge, but full ability to act. Now, Dogen numerology tells us some things about the nature of these universes. In Dogen numerology, three is the number of the male. That, on a biological level, compares to the three branches of a Y chromosome, which determines whether a person is male. Four is the number of the female. That compares to the four branches of an X chromosome that determine whether a person is female. Seven is the number of the individual. Now, as the cosmology progresses, the Dogen happen to drop the casual statement that four, okay, the symbolic reversals that occur over time in the cosmology. And so sometimes certain symbols take on the reverse, the opposite meaning of what they have in other contexts. The Dogen say that four is the number of the material universe, which is considered to be male. But the implication is that three is then the number of the non-material universe. But more importantly, that together, seven is the number of an individual, which implies that the two universes together, with their interaction, might constitute an individual. Now, for an individual, for a human, there is a situation that a human can get into where they have perfect consciousness, but an inability to act. This situation is called locked-in syndrome. Back in the last decade, there was a book and then later a movie called The Diving Bell and the Butterfly. It was written by a Frenchman who suffered a stroke at the wheel of a car, had a car accident, and was considered to be brain dead after the accident. But in France, they take a person like that to the home, and they care for the person, even though they can't move, they can't communicate, they still are caring for them and as long as they're alive. Mm-hmm. So all that this guy could do was blink his eyes. He was fully conscious inside his mind, but nobody knew it. Well, over time, he managed fortuitously to convey to one of his caretakers that he was still in there. And that caretaker set up a system for him of being able to blink in response to letters of the alphabet, and in that way be able to convey a word. Eventually, this guy wrote an entire book one letter at a time, wow, conveying words by blinking. Now, when nobody knows you're in there, it's a horrific state to be in. It's like being buried alive.
Yeah.
Now, my outlook on the universe is that the non-material universe, which we're about to become, the ascending universe, the one that's becoming less material, that about a third of the way into the process figures out where the trend is headed, realizes that where they're going to end up is in a locked-in state where they have full consciousness but no ability to do anything. But at the same moment that they're in that state, the descending universe is going to be furthest removed from its ability to know that the non-material universe is even there. So the one guy that the non-material universe has to act as a caretaker who might be able to help it communicate is going to be in a position where they have no concept that the non-material is even there. And so the non-material side decides to take action on that. What they do is, because of the way this energy scrolls between the two universes, if you think of it as a difference in pressure, what we do when we have a difference in pressure, like in a submarine or in a spaceship, when the outside is a very different pressure from the inside, we create an airlock. And in that airlock, we essentially equalize the pressure with what it is outside, and then we can move from the airlock into the other domain. Mm-hmm. Well, the same thing happens with the scrolling energy, that over time, if you imagine the scrolling of this energy as representing a great year, at the equinox of that year, the mass on both sides of the coin in the non-material and the material universe should equalize. And at that point, theoretically, it becomes possible to cross over from one to the other. Now, in ancient Egypt, the equinox was represented by the concept of Kepler, the dung beetle, who represented the idea of non-material, non-existence coming into existence. In Judaism, that same concept is represented by a holiday called Yom Kippur or Yom Kippur, same idea of non-existence coming into existence. At the other equinox, Judaism celebrates a holiday called Passover. And Passover, a traditional Passover Seder, is ended with the opening of a door to allow a symbolic non-material entity named Eliyahu to enter. So in other words, Judaism is acting out at the equinox the very thing that I'm suggesting the mass says should be possible, the possibility of a consciousness from the non-material side being able to enter the material side at the equinox. So about a third of the way into this process, the non-material side figures out that if it's going to have a caretaker when it's locked in, it needs to create a structure for material society that allows us on the material side to retain the memory of the fact that the non-material side exists. If we don't know it's there, we can't be its caretaker.
Right.
So they set up the esoteric tradition, which is actually patterned after the relationship of the two universes, whose purpose is to filter out the sincere people who will serve as caretakers, the ones who are attuned enough to an awareness of the fact the non-material is there to preserve it even when the universe is fully descended, and who are sensitive enough to the attempts to communicate knowledge from one side to the other. According to Samkhya, there are routine attempts to communicate information from the non-material side to the material side. They take the form of vivid dreams, of what appear to be coincidences of daily life, the unusual behavior of animals. Information can be communicated through clairvoyance and through divination and things like that. So the purpose of this passing over from the non-material to the material side is to deliberately set up a structure for society, an educational structure that will guarantee that the non-material side will be aware of the material side will be aware of the non-material side's existence at the point where the non-material side needs us.
Wow.
Yeah, wow.
That and that kind of ties into the whole sacred geometry stuff as well.
Yeah, it does, because the sacred geometry defines the geometric relationship between these two universes. It defines the kind of overlap that exists at every point in space and time where that ether unit forms. And it defines the overlap in the way time reconciles itself between the two universes, giving visibility to where that equinox is. And that's that provides the parallel to which we have to think about the way this energy scrolls on a macrocosmic level to be able to conceptualize what's going on here.
Huh. Okay. And of course, this is all fleshed out even more so in your book. So if anyone's having a little trouble following this, you lay this out beautifully in the book in great detail.
Well, thank you. Now, it's not just the Dogen and the Buddhists who think this. The Kabbalists flatly say it also. The Kabbalists represent the scrolling energy as a primordial Torah scroll, that they are comparing. Essentially, they're saying that the everyday reading of a Torah scroll in a Jewish temple is symbolic of the scrolling energy, and that every day they read, they communicate a piece of knowledge. Every temple, every Jewish temple in the world is reading the same portion of the Torah on the same day. And when they finish that, they roll the scroll a little bit more and read the next portion the next day. That whole process is symbolic of how this energy scrolls.
Now, I remember when I was talking to Walter Cruttenton about all this, I got the impression that he felt that we were more in a relationship with Sirius, where we're kind of rotating around the same gravitational center as Sirius. And that what caused the change in consciousness is the proximity of Sirius to us.
I'm not up to date with Walter's latest thinking about this. The last I knew, he was attributing the Yuga effect to the electromagnetism at the center of the galaxy.
Okay.
Whether that's still his perspective or not, I'm not sure. I think that he's moved away from the idea of a traditional binary star relationship between Sirius and our sun, mainly because we don't have any evidence that gravity can work at that great a distance. It's about, I think, 8 or 12 light years.
Right, right. And that is one of the things actually the electric universe can solve, because electrically connected objects could connect at that distance.
They could at a quantum level.
Yeah.
Right.
One of the really interesting things that you have in this book is you're talking about the concept of God and deities, and how these things don't really seem to exist in these ancient traditions. They seem to just be metaphors that later became more literal to people who believed in them.
Right. That if you look at, the Dogen society is dedicated to trying to preserve original forms. Now, where the Dogen are describing scientific concepts and stages of creation, we see the Egyptians using the same words to describe deities. The whole process of evolution of this tradition from the Göbekli Tepe era forward is one of things that were represented through icons and through objects becoming anthropomorphized. First, symbolic concepts were associated with animals. Then those animals became avatars of anthropomorphized deities. The Dogen provide us with ways of conceptualizing, categorizing symbols. One of those is based on the animal kingdom. These are four-stage metaphors. The one that we're most familiar with probably is water, fire, wind, and earth.
Mm-hmm.
That if they're talking about earth, they're talking about symbolism that pertains to the uppermost stages of this process. If they're talking about water, they're talking about the beginning stages. Well, the metaphor for the animal kingdom runs insects, fish, four-legged animals, and birds. Well, we can use that metaphor to interpret the symbolism of the Egyptian gods, that Kepper, who has the head of an insect, represents non-existence coming into existence, which is a very foundational, very beginning stage, and Thoth, who has the head of a bird, represents the concept of the word, which is an ending stage of the symbolism. We can place the symbolism of these Egyptian deities based on that set of metaphors. So yes, that from my perspective, what was originally purely a scientific, non-judgmental scientific view of how things work, and a very accurate one, that over time for different traditions took on other representations and eventually came to be deified. The concept of deity for the Dogon, the French anthropologist said that there was one Egyptian mythological character, a character named Amma, who was the only character who rose to the modern definition of what a deity would be, a creator god. But in fact, the symbolism that connects to Amma and it connects to the spiral of matter aligns very well with the Buddhist symbolism and the Hindu symbolism. But in Hinduism, Amma was the name that Ganesha, the elephant god, the affectionate term that he called his mother Sati by. So Amma is originally a feminine name, not a masculine one. So it's not a creator god, it's a goddess. This is part of the symbolic reversals that happen cross-culturally that I was talking about. We can understand why those reversals happen based on another example. Imagine you get on a plane on the East Coast and you fly to the West Coast. Now, you might be on the plane with hundreds of other people, and chances are you don't know anybody else on the plane. Maybe that you don't even speak to anybody else on the plane. And yet, by the time you reach your destination, everybody on the plane knows to turn their watch back 3 hours. Now, how can they know to do that? This is the same effect we're seeing with these cultures, all shifting symbols, symbolic meanings, reversing symbolism at approximately the same era. The same symbolic shape in one culture gets shifted to the same symbolic shape as another culture shifts. We have it's a very confusing thing. The obvious thing is the replacing of matriarchy with patriarchy. It's one of those shifts. Well, if we think about the scrolling energy, a lot of the symbolism pertains specifically to the non-material, the less material or the more material realm. That the shape of a square represents the concept of the material realm. The shape of a circle represents the concept of the non-material realm. But if we have a process that's a 12,000-year process that begins at Göbekli Tepe around 10,000 BC, then midway through that process, about 6,000 years forward, the universe that was less material is suddenly now the more material one. We have energy that has scrolled, and we're more than halfway done. More than half the sand has shifted in the hourglass. So now the symbolism has to shift because the universe, the symbol that used to represent the R side of the equation, which was a circle, now has to become a square because we're the more material side. Same thing. The non-material is considered feminine. The material is considered masculine. We pass that equinox, which would have happened sometime after 4000 BC. The representation now that used to be feminine now has to be a masculine one to be correct symbolically. I can tell one of the differences between a Buddha stupa and a Dogon granary is that the Buddha stupa culminates in a square base and a rounded top. A Dogon granary culminates in a square top and a rounded base. I can tell from that, based purely on the symbolism and this idea of the scrolling energy, that the Dogon form has got to be the archaic form. In archaic times, our universe was the less material, and we're represented, the concept of the earth, which is what the base is touching, would have been round. By the time we pass that equinox, now the base needs to be squared. So we go and we look at things like the Great Pyramid, which has a square base, and we can't tell which cycle the pyramid was built in. It might have been this cycle or it might have been a previous cycle, if we're thinking about the great year as a cycle.
Mm-hmm.
But we do know, we can say with symbolic certainty that it was built during the second half of that cycle.
Huh.
Because it has a square base.
Okay. Okay. Are you familiar at all with the holographic theory of the universe?
Yes, and the Dogon connect to that. They say that what we're seeing from a material frame is a reflected image, a shadow or a reflected image of what really exists in the form of waves. They add that from their perspective, it's a correct reflection of that, what exists actually in the form of waves. Now, this isn't hard to understand because it's the same concept that connects to the idea of Wi-Fi. I mean, the picture you see on your screen exists as waves at your Wi-Fi router.
Right. Right. Or a television screen.
Or an old television, you know, analog television where they were broadcasting a wave through the air that your television could pick up and convert to an image. Well, that's the way reality works, according to the Dogon, that we're seeing an image, but it's only a reflected image of what the reality is. The reality exists in the form of waves.
So one of the things you deal with in the book that I'm sure is a little controversial just in general is the symbolism behind circumcision.
Right. Now, circumcision, okay, we're talking about three parallel themes of creation. Now, if we're talking about the formation of matter, the first coherent shape that forms on the material side is angular momentum, which is the circle with the dot in the middle of it. It's the sun glyph. It's the shape of a sundial. If we're talking about the universe, the same shape is the first coherent shape that appeared after the Big Bang. I have a picture that I reproduce in the book that they have used measurements of modern astrophysics to determine that matter after the Big Bang organized itself at discrete distances from itself and produced a circular shape that's just like that. Now, the parallelism of the themes implies that there should be the same shape at the same stage of biological reproduction. Now, the organ that's responsible for initiating biological reproduction is the penis. So to impose that circular shape on a penis is placing the right symbol in the right place according to that, in relation to that theme. And now what it's symbolic of, though, is in Judaism, we're told that it represents a covenant. Now, if we think of the cyclical relationship between the two universes, where one of them becomes locked in and the other one is caretaker, and then 12,000 years later, the caretaker is locked in and the one that was locked in becomes a caretaker, there needs to be a contractual understanding between the two universes that it's each one's job to care for the other one when it comes to be time to do that. And so the essential covenant between humanity on the material side and the non-material side is reflected by circumcision, which is also at the same time imposing the picture of the cycle of that great year.
And of course, a lot of people aren't going to take to that nowadays. They're just thinking, you know, it's a bad thing.
Right. Well, even from a medical standpoint, circumcision creates similar damage and heals more quickly as the cut umbilical cord.
Mm.
That this is not a horrific thing that's being imposed from a male standpoint. Okay, all of the compassionate traditions that I've studied don't endorse female circumcision.
Right, right.
They come up with a reason why, even though symbolically there's parallelism that could be applied, they come up with compassionate reasons why it shouldn't be. But on a male, circumcision heals quicker than a pierced ear does. Hmm. This is not abuse. It is an effective way in ancient times of tagging the people who were instructed in the tradition.
Huh. Well, that's interesting. And I don't think most people think of it as a symbolic gesture, I guess.
Right. And they're trying to say, well, why are you mutilating this person? Well, from the perspective of the ancient cosmology and the perspective of medicine, this is not an abusive thing that happens. This is actually less abusive than cutting the umbilical cord is.
Okay. And one of the things that this tradition doesn't seem to touch upon, but you get into it a little bit, is the idea of consciousness and self-awareness.
Well, the dynamic that exists between the non-material and the material universe, because of the way the time frames work, the material side experiences time in moments. And one of the symbolic terms for that is a glimpse. When we see, in ancient Egypt, we see time measured during the daylight hours, which is symbolic of the material side, by the sundial, which moves in very fine, the shadows move in very fine increments around the circle. At night, in Egypt, time was measured in what's called glances. Time was measured at night by the progressive rising of certain constellations. And so you could count the 12 hours of the night one constellation at a time. This is an entire image at a time. This is the equivalent of a symbolic image as opposed to a moment.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a difference in perspective reflected even in the way time was conceptualized between day and night in ancient Egypt and the way that it works between the universes. Now, because of the way that time is experienced, the non-material side works from essentially overview. It can see many events at once, not just one. I compare the difference. If you think that time on the material side, it compares to a cassette tape that has to be played from front to back. Time on the non-material side is more comparable to a CD where potentially you can skip around track to track.
Okay.
Now, that's also the way the hemispheres of a brain work. One hemisphere of a brain is better equipped to see overview, and the other hemisphere is better equipped to see detail. In fact, when the symbol that ancient Egyptian language uses to represent the material half is that of a hemisphere. So the suggestion is that the dynamic that is being played out between the non-material and the material universes is essentially the same as the dynamic that plays out between the hemispheres of a brain. That this is a consciousness. This is, again, repeating the idea that we're looking at what's referred to in these traditions as a primordial individual. It's not deified in the archaic view. It's recognized as being a biological form.
Huh. Okay. And when you talk about these things communicating, I don't know if you mentioned it, but synchronicity is a part of this.
Yes, that one of the ways that knowledge is attempted to be communicated from the non-material to the material plays out in terms of what we see as coincidences. To my way of thinking, it's a lot like a game of charades, where by giving unspoken clues, one player is trying to get the other player to guess a meaning, essentially.
Right.
Okay? A person who becomes attuned to these synchronicities and finds ways for themselves to distinguish between what is merely a coincidence and what is a meaningful coincidence, that the more a person becomes practiced at doing that, the more they essentially call this effect to themselves. That it's as if you were traveling in a foreign country and you realized that there was one person on the ship who spoke a little bit of English. You would gravitate toward that person, the mm-hmm. one person who might be able to understand you if you didn't speak the foreign language.
That makes sense.
Same thing happens here, that successful communication fosters it. And so a person who gets that idea, a person who finally recognizes that there might have been some meaning to this image or this word or this idea that keeps popping up in seemingly random places in their daily life, and puts two and two together and goes and explores that and tries to figure out what can possibly be trying to be communicated by this, that sort of person encourages it to happen. And as they learn over time to pay more and more attention to it, they find it happening more and more thoroughly and more understandably.
Right. And you find that, I know you've had that experience while you've been studying this, first of all.
Yes. Anyone who works in the field that I work in, if I sit down for a private conversation with them and start talking about the odd sorts of things that started happening once I started researching these books, it like opens a floodgate, and it's like I'm talking to myself. They have story after story of things that just you would shake your head and go, that can't possibly be. Some of them end up being very tangible. Some of them end up being witnessed, which is fortunate, because anytime you have one that's witnessed, then you have someone who's in it with you who can say, yes, you're not just making stuff up here. I see that this is happening.
Yeah.
For me, one of the earliest examples was I was following Robert Temple's bibliography from The Serious Mystery to try to guide myself as to what book to read next. And there was reached a point where the book I wanted to read next was called Ancient Near Eastern Texts Relating to the Old Testament. This is a very thick scholarly book that reproduces the texts of all the Egyptian papyruses and all the various texts that have survived in ancient Egypt that have potential pertinence to the Old Testament. And so this was back in the 1990s, before you could go online and order a book off of an out-of-print book off of a website.
Right.
So I had exhausted all of the local sources I had, old bookstores and new bookstores, whatever, to try to come up with a book. I had even gone so far as to go to my old college, Vassar College. I went to their library, to their interlibrary loan service, and asked if they could possibly get a copy of it that I could borrow. And they couldn't come up with a copy. So I finally, out of frustration, came back to my wife, Risa, and said, look, you know, it looks like I'm not going to be able to get that book I needed. Well, a couple of days later, a box turned up on our back doorstep. Risa had an aging cousin who lived in a small apartment in Queens, New York. And every so often, he'd reach critical mass there and box up a bunch of random crap out of his apartment and mail it off to some relative to try to divest it from himself. Well, in this box that included all sorts of random things like oven mitts and, you know, oven timers and, you know, flags of the nation, my wife says, things like, you know, just really odd, eclectic stuff. Mm-hmm. There was my book. He had no idea that I had an interest in it. He had no idea that I was studying this stuff. He couldn't even recall when we talked to him about that he had ever even owned the book.
Wow.
But there was my book. That's the sort of tangible example of things, and there are many tangible examples of things that have happened that just shouldn't happen. At one point in my studies, I realized based on Dogen references and the way the symbolism plays out that the spiral of matter that the Dogen talk about has symbolic connections to Ganesha, the elephant god.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as I got further and deeper into the studies, I realized that parallelism and the symbolism implied that there should be a non-material spiral as well as a material spiral. These are the spirals of the scrolling energy. But that implied that there should be a female Ganesha. So I did some studying and discovered, yes, there were references to a female Ganesha in certain cultures. But more importantly, those spirals related to again and again and again to a concept of an embrace. And so I theorized that there should be images of this male and female Ganesha hugging each other or embracing each other. And I started looking for that, and I could find textual references to it having existed, but the image was banned by an emperor in China in 1100 AD, banned from inclusion on a master volume on, or set of volumes on Buddhism. As it turns out, images had survived in Japan. And so then I went online to see if I could turn up. Now that I knew what the Japanese called it, I could look to see if I could find any modern representation of it. What I turned up were descriptions of if you were going to make a statue of it or a figure representation of it, what requirements there were for that figure, what size it had to be, what material it had to be made out of, what features that figure had to display. So I found like an inch high version of it that I could order. Risa turned up on eBay out of a site out of India, an actual statue made to the right specifications, made out of brass, for about $35. So she ordered it, and the site said, well, please allow 6 to 8 weeks for delivery. I've had that happen before when I order from India.
Right.
So we thought, that's not a problem. At least we came up with an example of it. 2 days later, the box was on our back doorstep again. Now, actually, there's a representation of those hugging Ganeshas. That's the icon on the spine of my book, at the bottom of the spine. That's an actual photo of the figure we have.
Oh, yeah.
One of them represents the material universe. He has sort of a sun glyph shape on his head, and it represents the non-material.
Okay.
Now, that concept of an embrace is also what's represented by those odd amorphous arms that emerge out of the side of the pillars at Göbekli Tepe.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the really interesting things to me is that I understand, I can justify the concept that what they were trying to reflect there was the concept of an embrace. But whoever created that didn't have a sophisticated enough aesthetic sense to be able to produce it in a way that looks like an embrace. It doesn't look like an embrace. It doesn't look like a warm, familial embrace.
Right.
So it's a very interesting aspect of this whole process to see the learning curve on the part of whoever put the system together. Because when it comes down to being able to firmly state, here's what they were trying to represent and what they actually succeeded in representing, you see that they weren't very good at it at first.
Well, do you think Göbekli Tepe was the first?
In this cycle, yes. Yeah, I think that it was. I mean, well, that's a complicated question because where the Egyptians talk about a first time,
right,
and the Buddhists talk about a first time that knowledge was passed to humanity by a Buddha, The Dogon talk about a time when humanity was restored to culture. So the implication from the Dogon side is that was the first time in this cycle, but not the first time ever that humanity had been brought itself up to a high state of culture.
Okay. Well, that makes sense. If you have the cycles and stuff.
Right. Now, there are other metaphors that are employed that relate to this scrolling energy. One of them pertains to the colors of a rainbow, which, if you remember from elementary school, you use the acronym ROYGBIV, R-O-Y-G-B-I-V, to represent red, orange, green, blue, indigo, violet?
Mm-hmm.
Yellow, the yellow's in there. Okay, so the colors that are emphasized in the cosmological tradition are yellow, which... the word for yellow in all of these ancient traditions, or very many of them, is also the word for pale. And the anthropological name of the study, the name of the anthropological study of the Dogon, is called the pale fox. Paleness is an important concept. The other color that's emphasized is indigo, which is the color of the high priests. So that's one of the indications of where along this half cycle, this descending half cycle or ascending half cycle, that it becomes theoretically possible to cross over between the two realms. The indication is, as a matter of fact, we have images in Egypt where the horns of a horned deity span those same cut out same color range of a rainbow from yellow to indigo. The idea is that when you get 3/7 of the way into this ascending cycle, it starts to become thinkable to find ways to cross. And that when you get five sevenths of the way into the process, it stops being possible to cross over.
Okay.
So that's sort of the time span that we're looking at. Now, when you examine the names of the stages of the yuga cycle as they're given in these traditions, and examine the phonetics of those names based on Dogen phonetics, because the Dogen are the ones who do the best job of preserving the original meanings of the phonetics, you realize that the name for the era in which Göbekli Tepe would have fallen play out in terms of meanings that pertain to pillars and to animals. And each of the stages plays out in its own way in relation to these phonetics, appropriate to the era in which we see certain things happening. The ones that pertain to the Göbekli Tepe era around 4000 or 3200 BC pertain to that era, pertain to concepts of instruction, concepts of schools and things like that.
So do you think that's what Göbekli Tepe was, basically a learning place to pass on this tradition?
Yes, I think all the indications are that it must have been. That in some cultures, like ancient Egypt, you see over a period of time certain sacred sites being sort of refunctioned. That right. The ancient one is torn down and built over or built on top of.
Mm-hmm.
At Göbekli Tepe, you have multiple examples of what's essentially the same stone circle built again and again and again over a period of about 1,000 years. That wasn't a long enough period of time, and we can tell because of the digging up the buried structures, we see that the structure certainly wasn't a broken down structure. This was in perfect shape. Having buried it protected it. So they didn't repurpose this because it had become obsolete. So why are they building recurring instances of what's essentially the same temple structure in the same place? We can tell from ground radar that there are many unexcavated examples of this in the same spot.
Mm-hmm.
My outlook on that, based on what the Buddhists and the Dogen say, is those were final projects in stonemasonry for classes.
Huh.
We see this very similar thing happen at Orkney Island, where it looks as if each class excavated and raised one of the stone pillars in a stone circle.
Okay.
These look like instructional exercises. In Egypt, you have all the perfect work, all the artistic work that's absolutely letter perfect at the very beginning of the tradition. That,
right,
for me, is the shop teacher's example of the wooden bookshelf that he wants the students to build. And then the students build theirs, which never, ever even come close to measuring up to the example the teacher gave them to start out with.
I'm on the subject of synchronicities and such as well. You find anyone who is studying basically the paranormal tends to be led down that synchronistic path, whether it's magic or UFOs or whatever, which makes me think that if what you're saying is accurate, that there's some connection there. It's the same type of communication, just taking different faces.
Well, right. I mean, if we have a scientific concept of a non-material universe, then we have a potential explanation for all these quasi-mythical effects, quasi-scientific effects that we have not been able to pin down scientifically. We have a way of framing those from a scientific perspective that might demonstrate reality for some of them.
Yeah. Also, you talk about the H shape that you find all over the place. You also find that at the destroyed city there in South America, which the name of it's escaping me, but you have these giant blocks, these giant H blocks that they don't even know right. How they built.
Right. Yes, you do. That H shape is also reflected in the body configuration of the dung beetle in Egypt. Now, the way to understand what that shape represents is the most direct way of understanding it is when I wrote the book Point of Origin, I uncovered early 1900s article written in a Masonic magazine that explains what the Masons understood that shape to represent. And then from their perspective, it represents the coming together of these two energies of two universes, two energies of different qualities. One characterizes feminine, the other one characterizes masculine. And the H shape with a crossbar in the center of it is essentially the representation that's supposed to mean that. We find that at Göbekli Tepe as one of the symbols. It's right. Repeated in a couple of different forms on a couple of different pillars of the ones that we've excavated so far. The same concept is reflected in the Kanaga symbol of the Dogon. This is the big wooden H-shaped symbol that they carry around during their Sigi festival. You have it in various forms in various cultures. But it's also the essential configuration of that equinox in relation to the two descending and ascending phases of the Yuga cycle. That it's the bar across the middle that's significant. This is why all the religious holidays, so many of the religious holidays focus on the equinox. Mm. Now, the solstices, if you look at Egyptian language, the symbols used to write the Egyptian words for equinox, we understand that the equinoxes on one level were seen geometrically by the Egyptians, that each one represents an endpoint for a line. And two points define a line, and a line geometrically is the initial structure of existence, the initial indication of existence. A point has, it's actually a precursor of existence, but has no existence to itself geometrically. Two points, you can draw a line, and now you have something that constitutes existence.
Hmm. So why do you think they made them so large in South America?
There may have been more than just the symbolism going on there. I mean, that's the same form that you see concrete forms used on highways and to build buildings with in modern times. Sometimes they're configured in an H shape. These may have just been construction materials that happened to take the form of the shape of an H. Hmm.
But if I remember right, they're just kind of like this wall.
Right.
With this giant H on it, which doesn't seem to actually have any purpose of being there.
Right.
Unless it was made as a wall and they threw that in as symbolism as well.
Or they simply stacked them because they were going to use them and didn't get around to using them.
Well, that could be too. All right. It's funny how all this stuff just shows up everywhere.
Yeah, all the same stuff and with the same really complicated symbolism attached to it.
So do you think that there was, that this is just, that our loss of this knowledge is because of this cycle and not because of some kind of catastrophe that lost it?
Yes, over time, it's expected that the knowledge is going to be lost because of the way the descending cycle works. As a matter of fact, there's sort of a macho in Dogon culture about not having a written language, that symbolic language is seen as an inherently safer and better way to retain and preserve this knowledge than writing is.
Mm.
And there's almost a ridicule that attends the idea of writing something down, because writing it down implies writing it down in the context of a medium, some kind of media, and the media are not going to survive. Media itself is not going to survive, let alone the form of writing. The act of writing it down is seen as absolving the person who writes it down from actually having to master it and understand it.
Mm.
A person who is initiated in an oral tradition and is required to master mnemonic techniques for remembering this stuff is not going to lose it, is not going to forget how to convey it to the people that they teach generationally. It's seen as a much safer. Also, nobody can steal it. Nobody who shouldn't have it can acquire it.
Mm-hmm.
And symbolism is very powerful. When my wife and I, we had small children, we go to a county fair. And we were worried about, you know, what happens if our toddler child who doesn't know how to read and write yet, doesn't know their own address or their phone number. What happens if they get separated from us in some way at this fair? And so what we did was we taught them to sing their address and their phone number to the tunes of familiar children's songs in response to the question, where do you live or what's your phone number? And any adult friend of ours who has ever heard the songs automatically remembers our address and our phone number. Mnemonics are very powerful.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. All right. So this book is called Seeking the Primordial.
Right.
It is available where?
It's available through Amazon in the United States and in Europe. It's also been advertised and promoted to all of the regular retail bookstores, which means that any retail bookstore has knowledge of it, can order it, may or may not stock it on the shelves. Typically, one or more of my books is on the shelf. You can find them on the shelf at places like Barnes & Noble. I don't have firsthand knowledge whether this book is or not yet. With a company as big as Barnes & Noble, they make their stocking choices based on a national basis, which means right. If it's on the shelf at one store, it has a good chance of being there in every store. But it, the worst case is it can be ordered in any bookstore.
Okay, and it's available as an ebook as well?
Unfortunately, no. And the reason is because I published through this one through Create Space. And Create Space, in order to be able to handle the hieroglyphs that are in the book, required a PDF as the source document.
Okay.
From that, they produced what was supposed to be a Kindle-ready PDF, but even the one that they prepared can't be loaded into Kindle. I tried every format of file that Kindle will allow, and I couldn't get a coherent read on the manuscript into Kindle.
Oh.
And so looks like there may not be an ebook format on this book.
Oh, well, that sucks.
Yeah.
That's weird. Did it just not like the hieroglyphs?
No, it's more than that. Ebooks have got to be able to have flexibility of format for many different size devices.
Mm-hmm.
And the format of the PDF just doesn't lend itself to that.
I see. Okay. And now you have another book coming out, you think, probably around May.
Yes. Through the regular publisher, through Inner Traditions, is a book called Decoding Maori Cosmology. This is about the same cosmological tradition I've been talking about, only reflected in Polynesia, and specifically through the Maori culture in New Zealand. As it turns out, the Maori cosmological tradition and language reflects aspects of every era and every culture that I have written about.
Wow. Okay.
So I'm actually excited about that book. And don't mean to diminish it by having self-published this one. I just felt that this material was urgent enough that it shouldn't wait.
Yeah, especially if it's going to be another year and a half or so before it gets out there. This is rather mind-blowing to read through, honestly.
Well, and it's... in talking about the cosmology in general, it always leads to questions that bump right up against this stuff. And the problem for me is, as the author is, I could choose to talk about it without a book published.
Mm-hmm.
But first of all, that's not fair to the listener because they have no place to go and follow up with. If they're interested in what I'm talking about, they have no place to go and follow up with it. It's not fair to the publisher because I'm pre-announcing all the material that's going to be in a book. They're not going to get around to publishing for a year and a half.
Yeah.
So it made sense that, I mean, rather than, I had a few choices about what I could do. The one that seemed to be least stepping on the toes of the publisher, who I appreciate, was to self-publish it.
Yeah. And that way, so this is kind of like the background of all the stuff you're going to be talking about from now on, really.
Well, yes. Well, actually, the place where the next book seems to be going is that it may be time to talk about the overall plan of the cosmology from the perspective of those who put it together.
Okay, and that'll be 2 years from now.
Well, it might be. If I work quickly, it might be ready to go about the time where we've cleared the hurdle of the Maori book.
Okay. All right. That'll be interesting. This has led you in a way I'm guessing you never expected.
I had hints of it, but definitely this opened up dimensions to this material that I didn't imagine I was going to be able to get to.
Okay. And before I let you go, what is the latest you had heard about John Anthony West's condition?
Well, John doesn't live too far from me. In August and September, back after the hurricane hit Houston, he had been in Houston for treatment. His family managed to get him moved back out to his home, which is in upstate New York. And the original plan was to have him in a nursing home. But because of some logistical concern, they ended up not having a placement for him, and they kept him at home instead. And he's continued to improve, although he's had, all the way along, he's had ups and downs. The radical cancer treatments in Houston eradicated some 93% of the lesions that he'd had in his liver and his lungs and his brain. Mm. He had been comatose for a while and then regained his sensibilities and was able to talk to people and connect himself a little bit, although very diminished from what he had been before. Since he's been home, we've had conflicts. The day after he arrived back in upstate New York, my son and I went out to lead a tour in northern Scotland. And we're gone for a while. Then followed that up. Recently, I went to a conference in Virginia Beach. And then since that time, trying to get together, we've had family things that have prevented us from getting together with him. But I hope as soon as Risa is visitable again, gets over her, the cold that she has that we don't want to give to his family,
right?
That we'll be able to meet up with him and get a firsthand report on how he's doing.
Okay. Well, that's mostly positive, I think, considering what he's going through and his age.
He's probably 84 years old at this point. So,
yeah.
So any improvement that he manages is pretty spectacular.
Yeah. Well, let's hope he can get back to close to where he was.
Yep.
Do you have any speaking engagements coming up?
At the moment, there are no conferences scheduled. I've been doing webinars recently, which seem to be the trend. Rather than bringing somebody in to speak, they arrange a presentation from a distance. I've been doing radio and podcast interviews. I've done a couple of national radio shows recently. So I'm sure that will continue over the course of the next year and pick up again once the Maori book is available.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time, Laird.
Yep. Thank you very much. I always enjoy talking to you.
And a special thanks to our Patreons who are pledging at the $10 or above level. John Eddy, Chris Elmquist, Patricia Gaiaquinta, Roland Belstedt, Alfred Tuttle, Carla Mahoney, and Gabriel Zero. Thank you very much. Okay, and I hope you enjoyed that. We're going to take you out this time for the final show of 2017. With a song off an album entitled Songs of the Drow. And Jian is the artist, and you can find her on iTunes, Jaan, if you like this. And we're going to hear a song called A Hidden City. See you next year. Thank you.
You have been listening to Where Did the Road Go? This show is made possible in part from our Patreons, and we thank you and everyone listening for helping us continue this exploration of the strange. You can always find everything Where Did the Road Go related at www.wheredidtheroadgo.com. And thank you so much for your support.